Hi, my name is Johanna Zakaria, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Susie for asking me to come up here. It is, as usual, a terrifyingly intense experience. I'm glad to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm glad to be at this group again. Sometimes I have to look at my life and wonder if I've changed or not. And I want to tell you about that so that when I get going and I get carried away and lofty, you know what the truth is. And this has to do with my Christmas tree. And this is humiliating, and I need to talk about it. So this probably isn't the place to do it either. But I got a real large tree, much larger than is necessary. And but it was a good deal. So anyhow, I brought it home, and we enjoyed it. And finally, it was time to get it out of the house before there was a fire. And I was able to do that. It was hard to do, but I did it alone late at night in a fit of compulsiveness, and threw it over on the side of the house and got to looking at it. And where I live, they won't pick up things that aren't in the right lengths. You have to saw it apart. This is Orange County, and I have a real bad back, and I couldn't saw the tree apart. And so we came home New Year's Eve. I had some of the women with me, and I had noticed as we drove home that a neighbor down at the end of the block had a dumpster in front of his house. And I said, listen, why don't you help me get this tree down there? And there's a dumpster, and we can put it in there, and the entire problem is solved. And so we went down in the late at night in the dark with this very large Christmas tree and a car turned around the corner, and all of us, and everyone been sober for a while, instinctively dropped the tree and... We get down to the dumpster and toss it in, and I thought it would just sort of sink down, but it was full, and this tree was teetering on the very top, and it was late, and we were tired. We thought, well, it'll sink down during the night, and when I was up on my roof the next day taking down the Christmas lights, and that's terrifying. I'm terrified of heights. I do this just so I can prove that I can do anything if I want to do it badly enough, but... This may have been the last year. I was up on real high on the roof so I could see down the block, and I noticed this tree, and it's 10 feet tall, and it was wobbling on top of this dumpster. And I drove down the block a little later on, and this guy that owns the house was standing in front. And he's much smaller than I am. He's a little tiny man, and they had just moved in. And he had gotten this tree off the dumpster, and he had his hands in his pockets, and he was looking at it and shaking his head. And I feel real badly about this. I thought that this is really a crummy thing to do. Now it's his problem. And I worried about it all the rest of the week, and I didn't have the courage it takes to go down there and take the tree and haul it back down the street and say, I'm sorry, I did this, I'll never do it again. And luckily, yesterday morning when I drove down the street, the tree was gone and the dumpster was gone, and I thought, ah, God's will. You know... I have been approaching most of my life in this way for the last 12 months, and I want you to keep that in mind. I think I'm grateful that I have these rooms to come to and the people in my life that I do, because one of these ladies called me the next day, and she said, you know, you're my sponsor, and you asked me to do that. And I've had to learn how to... What I want to say, I've had to learn how to humiliate myself in sobriety, too. I've had to learn a lot of things in the last year, and I want to talk about a couple of those things now because I just know one way to tell my story. I can't afford any other one, so I always tell it pretty much the same way. And I want to tell you, in the last year, I have learned the greatest lessons of all. They have been as great as the lessons of my first year, and I've always thought that was the year I probably learned the most. And it has given me back the feelings that I had in my first year. And a lot of those lessons were very painful. It has been a difficult year in every area of my life. And I have learned that I have to throw myself one more time on the grace I find in the rooms and the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Jim Ryan used to stand at these podiums when he finished his talk, and he'd rub his hands together, and he would say, I love you. And I used to sit in these rooms new, and I would listen to him say that, and there was such passion in his voice when he said that. And I thought, you know, I thought that's sort of excessive. You know, I had no idea what it was that he was feeling. And what I am the most grateful for right now in my life was that I stayed here long enough to find out what it was he meant when he said those words. I know what he means. I know why I get to get up every morning and go through the day and go to bed at night and be okay. It's because I have these rooms and I have you people to keep turning to for everything in my life. And I never expected to need you. I never expected to learn any of the things I have learned. I never expected to get that far. I certainly never meant to need Alcoholics Anonymous, and not one of us ever does. I came from a perfectly normal Irish Catholic alcoholic home. And my being here in a lot of ways was probably predictable. You could never have told me anything of the sort. But I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about any of that tonight, because it's easy for me these days to linger in the past and what it was like so that I can avoid talking about the present, because it's been hard. And I'm trying to not do that anymore. And another reason that is it's just always been hard for me to talk about the years I grew up. It was an alcoholic home, and it was painful. And there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of tension and a lot of ugliness and a lot of bad times. And I have always found that hard to talk about. I know that a lot of us hear a lot of mixed messages as we grow up, and I heard them all, and I believed all of them all at the same time. You know, my mind has always been very busy trying to juggle it all. And I think I still sometimes tend to do that in sobriety. But there were a lot of people in my life as a little girl, because this was a Catholic home, a Catholic home. And they talked to me. There were families and teachers, and I'm the product of parochial schools. And I listened to these people, and you can listen to these things and reject them, or you can buy them, depending on your personality type. And I listened to these people, and I bought what they said. I wanted to be especially good. That was a very important thing to me. And what I look back today and suspect is that I felt if I could just be good enough, then everything else would be okay. Because I have had to learn in the last few years to take a look at my emotional patterns and my emotional reactions today and find out where they came from. I wish I had taken the time to do that earlier in my sobriety, and I didn't. I didn't even see it, though. And there's just a time when we finally have to learn how to put the pieces together. And today I see where a lot of the things I do and a lot of the ways I feel originated. And I went to a great length to try and grow up and be a really good girl. And I'll just leave it at that. And I did well in school without having to try very hard. It was always very easy for me. And I was bright. But more importantly, maybe, is I have always been someone who has found it easier to turn to books and things, you know, rather than turn to people. People have always been so hard for me. To this day, that can still be true. It's certainly how I grew up. And I graduated when I was 17 from a Catholic girls' school in Long Beach. We had moved here by then. And I have always remembered that day and how I felt. Because the world looked good to me, I had picked up a lot of ambition, and I knew exactly where I wanted to go and how I wanted to get there, and I rolled at Cal State Long Beach with a major in the sciences that next fall. And for a period of time, it was only going to be a short period, things fell in place for me there in a way I was used to academically. And then a lot of things began to change. A lot of the feelings I had began to change. And this was when I had my first experiences with drinking. Was not until that point in my life. And I went to one of these college fraternity parties, and that was where I had my first drink. The guy was with my date, and, you know, I still remember exactly how that room looked. I remember the way the walls were paneled and the way the furniture was laid out. I remember that room so clearly, I don't know why. But this guy was with my date, turned to me that night and asked me if I wanted a drink. And I know I didn't stand there and think about it. And my family is full of alcoholism. It has been a major problem for many of us. It's been fatal for some of us. But of course, it was never going to happen to me. I didn't need to think about it. And I said, well, sure. And the next question he asked me set up a pattern that I have tried to break with some difficulty here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that question set up an immediate and overwhelming desire to be cool. And a lot of us get there by one route or another. It became real important to me. It was a very simple question. You wouldn't think it had that much power. All he said was, "What do you want?" I didn't know how to answer that question. I was as naive and unsophisticated as it's possible to be at 17. I had no idea what to say. And I have spent most of my life trying to be whatever it was I thought you needed to see so that you would like me back. And I have always done that. I see that pattern in myself to this very day. Some things in me haven't changed as much as I would like to think. And I didn't want him to know that I had no idea what to say. And I said, "Y'all bring me whatever looks good." And that was a stupid thing to say, you know. And this was not a stupid man. You know, he brought me a tumbler of slow gin. And y'all know how he was thinking. And I finished that off and continued to drink through that night at that party. And all I know is to say about me and to say about my drinking, because it was never going to change. I was going to end up drinking only 11 years later, crawling on my hands and knees the same way I had started drinking that very night. All I know to say is to repeat what it says in the big book in the doctor's opinion, because it says there that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And I don't know anything else to say. You know, I drank that night, and the way the drinking made me feel was good. It made it easy for me to fit in, to party, and to socialize, to dance. I had never been able to do any of those things. I grew up so shy, so introverted, and so withdrawn. It was physically painful. And drinking changed all that. It was immediate, and it was a wonderful feeling, and no one could have convinced me that this was going to become a problem in my life. It goes on in that section of the book to say that as our drinking progresses, as time goes by, we lose the ability to differentiate between the true and the false. You know, that even though we know it is injurious, our drinking life begins to seem the only normal one. And it says, in effect, that we become irritable and discontented until we can again experience the ease and comfort that we see other people having with just a few drinks that they can take with impunity. And I know a lot about wanting ease and comfort. That's what I looked for every time I ever picked up a drink from that time on, because that's what it gave me. And it was my experience almost from the beginning that drinking was going to be a very, very big part of my life. It filled so many needs for me. And of course, the first of those needs were social. It made me fit with you for the first time in my life. And this was the 60s. It was a time on college campuses everywhere where there was a lot of demonstrations, a lot of radicalism. And time went by, and I was drinking more. I was carrying bottles around on that campus, and my attitudes began to change. And our attitudes do in our drinking, and then one more time in our recovery. And what I found attractive and what I wanted to be around began to shift. And I began spending a lot of my time with these people, and it was at that point that I began using a lot of drugs. I don't talk about it a whole lot. That was a major problem for me, too. And I ended up being arrested on that campus, and that was incidental. You know, it was a high point. Really, it gave you a little notoriety, but that was the 60s, and it was real important to get busted if you were putting effort into being cool. So I was loaded anyhow. I didn't care until I was bailed out late that night. And then I thought about having to go home and having to face that hard Irish father. And to this night, I have never met a harder man, and try and explain to him why I was in trouble. Again, this wasn't the first time there had been trouble. And rather than do that, I waited for the next afternoon when I knew he wouldn't be in that house. And I walked in with a couple cardboard boxes and emptied out a few drawers. And I never lived any other way until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I moved all the way down to Huntington Beach. That's a distance of about 10 miles, and I envy a lot of you your geographics. It sounds so exotic to me. You know, I never went anywhere. I never got up off the floor. Now, that's why I never went anywhere. This was not Huntington Harbor, and I always describe that little room, so I don't need to do it again tonight. It was small, and it was dirty, and it was cheap, and there were a bunch of us living there. And I remember laying on the mattress on that floor those first nights and, you know, looking around the room, and it was an ugly room. And thinking, you know, I hadn't been raised to be comfortable in a place like that. And I can remember exactly how I felt in the beginning. You know, I felt so comfortable. I felt absolutely at home. I felt as if for the first time in my life I was finally with people that didn't expect anything from me, that now I was free to do and to be whatever I wanted. And I was going to say that for a long time. I stayed down there the next year to 18 months before I moved back into Long Beach. And by then I moved back into Long Beach to run the streets, and I was very sick. I was not yet quite 21 years old, and I will tell you, I needed to be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was drinking very heavily on a daily basis. I was addicted to several different drugs. I had been arrested again. I had come to in a locked ward out at Norwalk for the first time I was there as a suicide. I had, of course, dropped out of college in my junior year. It's impossible to accomplish anything living the way I was living. And I had become very literally unemployable. And I did an inventory on that not long ago. I thought it's absolutely impossible that I lost every job I ever had. That's no doubt exaggeration on my part. And it isn't. I did. I would show up drunk or loaded, or I would just drift away. And a lot of that was the 60s, too. I had another solution for the problems of living for me, and I simply began moving in with what became a long line of men. I moved in with whoever would just take me in, and then I stayed there until I was kicked back out, because that is how it always was for me. And I know, especially if you're new, you may hear me doing no more than describing the circumstances of my life, and I am doing a lot more than that. What I am telling you is that I have always been someone, one way or another, who has said, I can't do it. You do it. You buy it. You fix it. You cover for me. You get me out of this one. You love me. I can't. And the doorway for freedom for me here in Alcoholics Anonymous was that when I came here, there were those who took the time to tell me that this was a decision that only I could make. You said you'd be there with me, but that finally I was the one that had to make this decision. And I know today, as I look back, that that gave me the opening into freedom that I experience today. I know what being free feels like today, and back then I only knew how to talk about it. I moved into Long Beach over near the west side, just off Anaheim Street on 14th and Rose. And some of you may know Long Beach, most of you probably don't. It's a very hard part of town, and I was very comfortable there. I was comfortable there because I felt like I was in a place where I didn't have to look over my shoulder, that everyone else was living the way I was living, and that I was safe, that I was home free. And it was just a few years later that I found myself over on the west side of Long Beach sitting on some stone steps, and I remember it was on Cedar, just south of Coast Highway, and looking at the ground as I sat there and thinking to myself, you know, this is it. This is how it feels to sell your soul. And I can't stand up here tonight and tell you that as I sat there, I cared, because I didn't. I was 23, and I felt old, and I felt all used up, and I felt all burned out. 23 is young to feel that way, and I was still some years away of getting to you. It hadn't been that many years at that point since I had walked away from that Catholic girls' school with all those hopes and all those dreams, all that ambition, and there I sat, absolutely helpless to change anything about my life. I sat on those steps and I was a drunk, period. That's what everyone called me. I had been drinking every day for a long, long time, and I sat on those steps that day as a heroin addict. And all I have to say from these podiums about myself and how I lived through those years is just to tell you that I am someone who has learned absolutely everything I ever want to know, I hope, about shame and degradation and humiliation and remorse, because that is a very dirty way for a woman to live. And I lived that way freely. You know, for a long time after I came to you, I wanted to say that it was conditions and circumstances that made me into the things I became before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And someone told me at one of my first meetings that I needed to learn how to take responsibility for my own life. And he was right. No one ever twisted my arm. I made every decision through all of those years based on my needs of the moment. And I'll tell you what I always said. I always said, I am free. I'm free and I'm living the way I want to live. I am hurting no one unless it's myself. And I had to come and sit in these rooms with you to find out that no alcoholic, regardless of what the externals of the story may be, knows anything about what freedom can be. You know, one way or another, we live in bondage. And I had to get to the amend steps to 8 and 9 to find out that the truth was that there had never been anyone in my life that I hadn't hurt, that I hadn't lied to, that I hadn't manipulated, that I hadn't stolen from, that I hadn't abused, sometimes very badly. That was the truth, but I couldn't see it that way then. And those years, to this day, are hard for me to talk about because you hear the words and I see all the pictures. And it was ugly. It was a lot of ugly years. Those years are a story for me of being in and out of all the little hotel and motel rooms up and down Anaheim Street and Coast Highway, all those little bars, all the little liquor stores. It's a story of being in and out of the pawn shops and the free clinics and the city jail. And this was not exotic felonies. You know, it was a drunk tank. Coming to out at Norwalk again on a locked ward, and I was there again as a suicide. It was about the blood banks down off the pike. You know, it was coming to in the morning, and I had always said I'm free, and my world had gotten so small. What I needed when I came to in the morning was a drink. I needed a drink right away. And a few hours later, I had to go get well. And these were the ways I found to solve the problems of living. And I lived that way through all of those years, and I never left Long Beach. And I came to sometime later now in a room in downtown Long Beach. And as I came to this particular day, I was laying in a hallway, and I have no idea how long I had been there. I was black and blue, and someone was stepping over me. And I propped myself up against the wall, and I looked around, and one more time, I had a solution for the problems in my life. And one more time, I was going to be wrong. I always am. Just like Jack said, when I come up with the answers all by myself, they're going to be wrong. I thought what's wrong in my life, as I looked around that room, was all the junkies I lived with. I thought it's no wonder I am always in trouble, because I like to look at things that way. I like it to be your fault. And I have a very strong sponsor named Sue. She lives in Orange, and she rarely lets me do that for very long. I'm grateful for that, because my mind will still work that way, what you have done to me. And it was always people, places, and things, conditions and circumstances. It was the cops. It was no money. It was bad luck, bad timing, crummy karma. It was never me, you know? And I ended up, and that's another story that takes too long, at North Long Beach. And I had cleaned up enough after a period of time to go out and try and find a job, because this was something I thought would help. That was something I hadn't done in a long time, and it seemed normal to me, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I knew a lot was wrong, but I didn't know what it was. There was a period of time at one point when a condition of probation was that I get psychiatric help, and I did that very, very briefly. And I believed I was schizophrenic or psychotic, and sooner or later someone would diagnose this, and then they could medicate me, and then I would be okay. You know, I didn't know I was going to wait years longer to sit in these little rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and have you give me the name of my disease. And so I went out and cleaned up and finally found a job, and that was not a real easy thing to do. I think it's perfectly obvious I did not have a resume or a list of references to hand out, and it had been hard to come up with a job, and I was desperate to keep it. And they fired me less than 3 months later as I walked in there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they fired me because I walked in drunk. It had occurred to me not to do a lot of other things. It had never occurred to me that I couldn't drink. I don't have a story that includes periods of controlled drinking. And some people do. And I believe them, but I was never able to do that. I always had tremendous problems with my drinking. It always caused me a lot of trouble. And when our book talks about the phenomena of craving, I know exactly what that means. I know how it feels to be willing to do anything and to go anywhere just to have another drink. I always needed the next drink so badly. And that was one of the first freedoms I found in this program with you, was when the day came that I realized that obsession was finally gone, that it wasn't the first thing I thought about when I woke up in the morning. And sometimes I forget what a freedom that is. I forget how it was to always be thinking about the next drink or finding a bottle or getting someone to buy it. I haven't had to think that way for so long, and I can sometimes forget, you know, how hard that was and what agony there was in it, and what pain there is in needing another drink and needing it right now. What I drank the last 3 years I drank was Santa Fe White Port. And I drank it because I liked it. and that's the truth. You know, it was also very cheap. That was a big part of why I liked it. But you can smell Santa Fe coming from a long ways away. And of course, they fired me right away as I walked in that office, and they gave me the money I had coming, and I went into this room, back to this room I was living in, and I continued to drink. And I'm going to talk about my drinking now, because I was at the end. I sat there alone with those bottles, and I would drink and pass out and drink and pass out again. And I would sit there and think, you know, today is just like yesterday, and yesterday was no good. And tomorrow is going to be just like today, and it's not going to be any good either. I was 27 years old, and I was waiting for it all to finally be over. They had been such hard years, and they had been so ugly, and there was nothing left inside of me to fight with anymore. I felt so beaten. There wasn't anyone to turn to. There wasn't anyone to bail me out of one more bad spot. I was absolutely alone. And a period of time in there is one that I remember, because it holds the moment that I always look back at for myself as describing pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And all of us have one of those moments if we end up staying here. And I needed another bottle, and I needed to get to that liquor store. And it was often real hard, really difficult for me to walk. And it took me a long time to get down the steps of this place I was living in. And I got out to the sidewalk, and I needed to go down to the end of the block and across the street, and that was where the liquor store was. And I got down to the end of that little street, and I stood on that corner. And I remember myself precisely that day. I remember exactly how I looked, and I remember how much I needed to drink. And I stood on that corner, and I became absolutely terrified, that overwhelming, deafening terror. I was afraid to set my foot off the curb. And it was a little street. It wasn't a large boulevard. And I was dirty because I couldn't take care of myself in any way anymore. And I was very thin because when I drink, I don't eat. And I was sick. And I was shaking. And I needed a bottle. And I couldn't cross the street. And I stood on that corner just as I was and wrapped my arms around myself. And I cried. And you see, in the end, that's how I was. I was pitiful. I have a mind which will always fantasize and always make anything sentimental. It will make something tragic out of anything. My mind works that way. That's my inner narrative. And I need to remember how I was and how I looked and how I smelled, because that's how I am when I drink. I was pitiful. I don't know how much time I continued drinking through that last period. I know that at some point I came to in the chair I had passed out in the night before, and I reached for a pint that was on the table next to me as I came to that morning to take a drink. And as I picked that pint up and held it in my hand, see, we never know when it's going to happen. There's no way to know when it's all going to be different. I held the bottle, and I saw myself for the very first time in my life precisely as I was. And I wasn't any of the things I had ever told myself. I held that bottle, and what I saw sitting in that chair is precisely what brought me to you, because what I saw sitting there was simply a hopeless, helpless woman alcoholic. I saw a drunk, period. And that was the beginning for me. I don't know the difference between beginnings and endings. I still don't. All I ever know is the pain and the hurt and the loss, the strangeness of the endings. It never occurs to me at those times that nothing ends, but that something else will not begin. That's how life is. And that's how it was for me that morning. I believe it is a gift for someone like me to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because of what I did next. I found a dime, and I went to a payphone in the building next door. I didn't have a phone. I didn't have anything, and I dialed information for the number of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still don't know why I did that. Until I learn differently, I have to believe that somewhere, at some time, I sat in one of those bars or one of those little rooms, and someone sat with me and talked to me about a place for people like me to go, and they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. All I know is that the name was there when I needed it, and it has been that way for me ever since. A woman came and picked me up and took me to my first meeting, and I don't remember it. I was too drunk. All I know is that when she dropped me off, she said, "You know, Johanna, you shouldn't be alone." She said, "I want to come back here tonight, and when I do, I want to take you to a woman's recovery house." And I had never heard of such a thing, and she explained it to me. She said it was a place where a group of women lived together, and she said they didn't drink, and they tried to help each other. And I'll tell you, I thought that was one of the most disgusting ideas I had ever heard. You know, a lot of women together in a house and not drinking, it just sounded really bad to me. And she came back that night anyhow. This is a woman who knew how to complete a 12-step call. I don't know if everyone would. I was not very impressive. And she came back that night, and all I know is that when she came to the door, I went with her. And she took me to a step house called Little House in Bellflower, and the house mother met me at the door. And we could not have been more different as people. That book says we are people who normally would not mix. We could not have been more different. And yet she walked up to me, and she put her arms around me, and she held me. And it was the first time I had felt good in a long, long time. She held me, and she said, honey, it is going to be okay. And I remember how good that woman made me feel, in spite of the fact that I knew she was wrong. I didn't even know what I was doing there. And they put me to bed, and I left sometime in the next 48 hours. I was hallucinating, I was sick, and I needed a drink. I needed a drink, I thought, a lot more than I needed you. My sobriety date is almost a year from my first meeting, and the only thing I was going to do right was to keep coming back. In particular, to that woman in that step house who was unfailingly kind. She always had a moment to take for me. She always tried to help me. She never thought I was too drunk or too hopeless or too shallow or too phony. She understood a lot about alcoholism, and she understood it almost instinctively. She had a great love for the sick woman alcoholic. And I finally became willing to stay there for a month later in that year, and I could no longer talk by that point in time. I couldn't put my words together. I couldn't make sense, and I couldn't make sense out of what you said. And you would read the things we read and talk in meetings, the way we talk, and none of it would come together for me. And it was after a book study meeting they held and had in that step house that a man crossed the room to me one night, and he shook my hand, and he said the most important words I have ever heard, and they remain the most important words in my life tonight. He said, Johanna, I just want to make sure you know that you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to. He said, you just don't have to do it that way no more. And I had sat there and heard you talk about sobriety, and I wasn't sure that I wanted it. And I heard you talk about not drinking, and I didn't think I was going to be able to do that. But what he had told me in saying that was I didn't have to go back out on those streets and keep doing what I had been doing to get there in the first place. And I stayed the rest of that month in that step house. And I had a lot of difficulties with many areas of this program in the beginning. I couldn't find an idea of God that I could use because... And I have long since made my peace with the way I was raised. I really have. I look back and I don't have any criticism to make. I have a lot of gratitude. But I could not use the idea of God that I had grown up with. It wouldn't fit for me as I was in that step house. And what I had come to believe was, since this was so important for you, I was going to have to leave. And I sat up one night looking what I thought for the last time at a copy of the steps, knowing I might as well take off. This would never work for me. And all I can tell you is my experience, because I don't have anything else to give you. And I sat there, and I got what I needed that night. And I always do, simply because I asked. I had surrendered without understanding what you meant by surrender. And all I mean by that is that I had stopped fighting whatever it was I had been fighting all of my life. And when I did that, something else could enter. And I began to make my way through this program the way we all have to. And I'm not going to talk about the first year. I don't have a lot of time. But I will tell you that was the year where I made the greatest discoveries and the greatest changes. And by the time I took a cake for 1 year, I was at step 12. And I'm glad I got sober where I did. It was a large, active, very involved group, and they laid a foundation for me that I will always be grateful for. I came here single, and I expected to remain that way. I didn't believe for a long time that I was worth having. We talk about self-esteem and worthlessness, and I always know what you mean when you say that. I felt that way, too. And I began dating a man from my home group, and we broke up and provided the customary entertainment for the group, and and we got back together, and when I was 15 months sober and he was 9 months sober, we got married. And this is what I always balk at talking about, because the history of my sobriety has been so intertwined with the history of my marriage. It's all of one piece. And there were many, many good things through the next 11 years, many, many good days, And I'm grateful for all of it. I learned how to live in peace with another human being, and that's very hard for someone like me. It has been the hardest lesson of all. You know, you can put me in a room with a catatonic, and there's going to be a lot of trouble in just a few minutes. True. And I learned in a lot of ways, not completely, how to try and just keep my eyes on myself. And a lot of good came from those years. We moved to Orange County and bought a home. We started a family. And I thought that was the way it was supposed to be and it would always be. And some 4 years, maybe longer ago, he went back out and had a very difficult time coming back. And I stood at the podiums and talked a lot about how grateful I was that we keep our hands open and the doors open for those that need to come back. And if there are any of you here tonight, I still mean that. It's just here. Just come back. And it was hard for him. And time went by, and he said he was doing it. And it wasn't until not this last summer, but the summer before, that I stood at a birthday party for my youngest son in our backyard. And I looked at him, and you know, he had to weigh about 118 pounds before I understood what was wrong. I don't know, and I don't talk about it a lot from the podiums, but I was an addict. I don't know what I thought I was looking at those few years before. All I can assume is that I wanted to live happily ever after a lot more than I wanted to call things by their right name. I learned how to deny and manipulate reality as a child, and in a lot of ways, I still have a big problem in that area. It's hard for me to see anything I don't want to see. And he had a horrible time from that point on, and he finally went to a step house up north, and when he came back, he said, you know, the greatest single problem I will have in staying sober is staying married, and he said, I'm going to go away, and he did, and our divorce was final this last summer, and it is hard. It's hard to let go of the dreams. It's hard to try and make another start. It's hard to say, thy will be done, when you know it should be different. You know, and that is what's hard. That's the killer, is I always think I know how it should be. And when it isn't, I have a lot of trouble going ahead and surrendering. I will tell you that out of all the pain, and there has been a great deal of pain in the last year, that I have finally gotten to a point that I haven't known since I was in my first year, and I am sober almost 13 years now. I feel just like I did when I was a newcomer. I feel that absolute surrender and that willingness to take it just today, and when I say, thy will be done, to mean it. And the words come so easy, and the doing it has been so hard. It's been very hard. I think I want to say that as hard as it has been, the price is not too high. And I have these sons, and we still have a home and a life together. And time to stop. There's all these other things to say. I better not say them. I want to tell you that being a mother is important to me, and that I love my children, and that you have taught me how to have enough to give. I have learned about loving because you loved me. You know, I didn't know how to love myself. You had to love me first. And I found it for me because it was reflected from you. There's a line in our book that's repeated many, many times, and it's very simple. It says the great miracle for us is that we have discovered a common solution. And some part of me has always known from the very beginning that that's got to be another way of saying that together, because we need each other so much. I have never needed you more. Together, we do not have to live that way anymore if we don't want to. And I mean it with all of my heart today. It's my business to thank you for the seat I took when I was new and for the one I'm going to take now, and to tell you in a very particular way that I love you and thank you.